and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an assessment of why the Democratic National Committee, headed by Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, apparently buried the Democratic presidential debates to make them non-events, instead of an opportunity to offer up an alternative to the hateful and divisive vision the Republican candidates are offering the country in their debates that are generating many times more audiences with record ratings. A Democratic strategist who served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House, Mike Lux, a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies, joins us. We'll discuss his article at the Huffington Post, What Are Democrats to Do?, and the brain-dead petty politics of the DNC tipping the scale for Hillary to hurt Bernie Sanders that ends up hurting the Democratic Party and American democracy. Then, with the recent arrest of the poster boy for greed, who jacked up the price of a 62-year-old life-saving drug by 5,500%, we'll look into why drug prices in the U.S. are higher than anywhere else in the world and speak with Arthur Kaplan, a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He joins us to discuss whether jailing one nasty little twerp is a distraction from the fact that the cost of the top brand-name drugs in the U.S. jumped 127% between 2008 and 2014, while they stayed the same in the U.K., where they pay three times less than we do, along with Brazil, where drugs cost six times less, and India, where they cost 16 times less than we pay. Then finally, we'll go to the UK to speak with Andrew Jennings, an investigative journalist who was the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. We'll discuss Sepp Blatter's eight-year ban from soccer and whether FIFA itself should be banned, as well as Andrew Jennings' latest book, The Dirty Game, The Reporter Who Brought Down Sepp Blatter. And joining us now is Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995 and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, What Are Democrats to Do? Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lux.
Thank you, Ian. It's good to be back here with you. I always enjoy your shows.
Oh, thank you, Mike. And I want to talk to you about your article at the Huffington Post. But just before that, I'd like to talk about the last of the Democratic presidential debates on Saturday night. And I find it extraordinary that the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, headed by Debbie Wasserman Schultz, their strategy appears to have been, and it's a successful one at that, to bury these debates, to make sure that as few as possible Americans watch these debates. And it seems to me, and I'm not the only person who feels this way, David Axelrod suggested that they put their finger on the scale in favor of Hillary Clinton, Debbie Wasserman Schultz has, and to the detriment of Bernie Sanders. If this is true, they have to be the most brain-dead people in the world. Why would you want to bury your message at a time when the Republican message is so ugly? And why wouldn't you want to introduce yourself to the American people as the alternative to this ugliness?
Well, Ian, you always ask good questions, and those are excellent ones. I'm very confused by the strategy, if it is a strategy myself. I don't want to claim to know, the inside workings of the DNC, but it certainly does appear with so many fewer debates than in the past, with putting them at times like Saturday night before Christmas, it does appear that they're trying to bury these debates. And I think that is a huge strategic mistake on their part. And in fact, I think it's very bad for Hillary, most of all, if you assume, that she is the front runner, and you assume that she's going to be the nominee, to not have her message get out there more widely, I think, is very damaging. And I think we've seen it. the Republicans are getting all the attention. They're the ones with the interesting debates. They're the ones that people are talking about. And they may be talking about them in a negative way, but they're the ones being talked about. And so so I think it's a problem for Hillary, and I think it was a big mistake by the DNC to have so few debates and to bury them in the way they have.
But it looks as though the strategy has been to bury Bernie Sanders and to protect Hillary Clinton from a possibility that she might make a mistake or something, which certainly has not been the case. And that, when you just say, Mike Lux said, it would help Hillary Clinton to have more exposure, most of all, I think it would help surely Bernie Sanders, because, you know, nobody thinks he's a shoo-in for president, but it's sure different to have a Democratic socialist out there pushing the envelope in terms of our rather constipated and narrow political debate.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Look, I think Hillary has done great in these debates for the most part, and I think she's made some mistakes, but overall, I think she's been great. So I think it would have helped her. I think it would have helped the Democratic cause, but I certainly also think it would have helped Bernie Sanders, but, you know, to get his message out. And I think it's unfortunate that there's been a decision made to, you know, to try to just sort of be boring, you know, like have the whole primary election be boring. I don't think boring voters is the right answer, and I feel like that's what some of these decisions have led to, whatever the intent was. So I just think it's healthier for the whole party to have our ideas exposed, because, you know, our ideas are actually, for the most part, you know, Bernie's ideas, and I think to a great extent Hillary's ideas are actually quite popular with you know, a wide majority of the American public. And I think if they got, you know, more exposure, that would be a healthy thing for everybody.
Well, but it looks as though for sort of petty partisan pro-Hillary reasons, Debbie Wasserman Schultz tried to make them boring, tried to make them inaccessible. Here on public radio, for example, Mike, we couldn't play the debates. We normally can play them because Debbie Wasserman Schultz gave an exclusive contract to Westwood One.
Wow.
Which guarantees
I didn't know that.
Yeah,
so
nobody got to hear them on radio. You know, that means people in their cars. It's to me, the strategy is so obviously clear that they think they're helping Hillary and hurting Bernie, but they're hurting everybody, and most of all, they're hurting democracy.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't make any sense. You know, the other thing is, and whether it's the debate or whether it's the way that this whole data breach thing was handled by the DNC, you don't want to feed the narrative that the party establishment has their thumb on the scales, whether it's true or not. And I'm not going to attack anybody's motives or intent, but whether it's true or not, to have that perception out there, which definitely that's what all of the sort of progressive activists I talk to are under the impression that the DNC does have their thumb on the scale. Axelrod is far, far from the only person to think that. And that's just not good for either the party, but more importantly for Hillary if she's the nominee. It doesn't help her to have people think that she's the hand-picked person of the establishment. It doesn't help her to have all these progressive activists think that they're trying to stifle, you know, the debate and the campaign of Bernie Sanders. How does that help unite the party at the end of the day? And so I just think it's a very, very unfortunate mistake.
And again, I'm speaking with Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the president for public liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and is the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, What Are Democrats to Do? So let's talk about your article. And the Democratic Party seems to be, in a curious way, two parties, the one that wins the executive branch and the one that loses the legislative branch and the state houses. And it seems to be sort of disconnected, doesn't it? I mean, as you point out in your article, the Democrats have won more votes for president in 5 of the last 6 presidential elections and 3 of the last 5 elections in general. So why do they only end up with the executive branch?
Well, part of it, Ian, is bad luck. The fact that we had one of the worst years in history for the Democratic Party in a redistricting year was terrible luck. The Republicans close to swept the table in governor's races and state legislative chambers. And when you lose that badly in a redistricting year, you're in trouble for the decade in terms of, congressional seats and in terms of state legislative chambers and winning those back. So part of it was that dynamic and that particular kind of bad luck. But I think it also goes deeper. I think one thing that I have noticed over the years is that in years when Democrats do well, even when we're winning a lot of the key close elections, even when we're winning the presidency overall, and a lot of the big Senate races and governor's races and House seats, we don't win by the kind of big margins that Republicans do in their best years. We haven't been able to run up the score, and I think the dynamic in the two parties is this: Democrats tend to be sort of, in general, too many Democrats tend to be too cautious, too careful, and sort of on their own. They don't work in tandem with other Democrats and with the progressive movement to turn people out and to build momentum. They kind of run very individualized races, and they tend to be on the cautious side. It's hard to build a tidal wave when you're being cautious. The Republicans, on the other hand, when they're in a bad year, they double down on trying to turn out their base, because they figure if they can get more base turnout, it might save them in a bad year, generally Republican candidates. And in fact, it does. And if you look at the last few elections where Democrats have done well, rather than blowing them out and winning 50 new House seats, which was possible in 2006, for example, when we won back the House, we only won 31. In 2008 and 2012, where we picked up House seats and did pretty well, we didn't win as many as we could because we were running cautious. The Republicans were doubling down and trying to turn out their base. Whereas when we're having a bad year, what Democratic candidates do is run away from the party. They see the national trend and they're like, this is awful. We have to pretend we're not Democrats and try to convince people that we're not Democrats. And so instead, we depress our turnout, and people don't vote in the elections. It's like when Alison Grimes in Kentucky said she wouldn't tell people who she voted for in the last election. Well, that did not help her with black turnout or with progressive turnout in that election. And at the moment she said that, she was doing pretty well in the polls. After that, she just dropped because people thought that she was partly because they thought it was a goofy thing to say, but mostly it was the drop with Democratic base voters. They thought, well, if she's not willing to, stand up for Democrats, why should we bother to vote? So you build in these dynamics, and as a result, the Republicans just crush us in the years where they're strong, and we win modestly in the years where they're good Democratic years. And that's the biggest reason you're seeing the trends that you've seen over the last few elections.
So, Mike Lux, though, if it all goes back to 2010, the census year, where Karl Rove was highly organized, lots of money from the American Petroleum Institute, hit the ground running, won all of those governorships and all of those state legislatures, What's the explanation for why the Democrats didn't see it coming? Why were they caught flat-footed?
Well, it was honestly, you know, and I will be blunt here. It was just a bad political strategy by Obama, and in part it was the failure to move aggressively and the message aggressively on the health care bill. They allowed it to get bogged down in the Senate forever, and instead of a really important groundbreaking victory that gave them momentum going into the election year, they had this 14-month long, ugly, ridiculous battle where they didn't win on message at all. And then in the election, they didn't try to generate enthusiasm among the Democratic base. I can remember countless frustrating conversations with the White House political team where they didn't care. They thought the way to position themselves was in the middle, and there was even, like, you know, you remember Robert Gibbs talking disparagingly about the professional left, and, you know, all of the sort of insults and, you know, different things that they did with the Democratic base, and it was just it was a fiasco. The Rahm Emanuel led White House was a fiasco politically, and the Democratic candidates on the ground couldn't recover from it.
And when you mentioned earlier Alison Grimes, of course, she was running for the United States Senate in the state of Kentucky against, of all people, Mitch McConnell, the guy that the Democrats should have defeated. And he, of course, is now the majority leader of the Senate. And it would have been both substantive and symbolic to have gotten rid of him.
It would have, and Democrats put you can't fault the amount of money they put in. They put in plenty of money to beat him, but the campaign narrative was awful. You had Alison Grimes saying she didn't want to say who she voted for. You had Alison Grimes running ads attacking immigrants, so further depressing both the, you know, the liberal Democratic vote and the Hispanic vote that's in Kentucky. You had a decision to spend all this money on TV ads going after voters she was never going to get, and not enough on get out the vote organizing. So you just had this very poorly thought through campaign from a strategic point of view. Again, the strategy was, let me look as much as like a Republican as I can, and hope that I can, thereby win. When you're a Democrat in a red state in a tough year, you actually have to explain to people why you're a Democrat, because their tendency, you know, in a red state, in a tough year for Democrats, their tendency is going to be to vote against you. You have to give them a reason to vote for you. You have to say, look, I'm proud to be a Democrat. Here's why I'm a Democrat, and here's why I'm running. And then create a populist campaign. That doesn't mean that you have to, you know, go with the national party on every issue. But it does mean that you have to, like, be willing to say, look, this is why I'm running as a Democrat. I'm proud of who I am. I'm proud of my party. This is why I'm running as a Democrat. And I'm going to help. I'll give you another example. Mark Pryor, the minimum wage was on the ballot in Arkansas. It won overwhelmingly. But Mark Pryor, rather than embracing the minimum wage and running ads about the minimum wage and talking in his stump speech about the minimum wage, even with it on the ballot, he thought, well, that's too Democratic a sounding issue. I don't want to seem like a Democrat. And so all these people who were voting for the minimum wage, you know, didn't end up voting for him because he never talked about it. They didn't make the connection that, oh, Pryor's a Democrat and he's for the minimum wage. So, I mean, we're running brain dead campaigns in a lot of these states.
And, of course, the consequences of that Mark Pryor's loss was that we got Tom Cotton, one of the most sort of ignorant and reactionary buffoons we've ever had in the Senate. So,
yeah.
So, but tell me just in the last couple of minutes then, Mike, where do the Democratic Party professionals, the DNC types, the people that decide who the candidates are and what the candidates campaign on, where does this idea come from that you've got to look like Republican light to win in red states instead of standing up, you know? Because let's face it, all you ever hear on the right, particularly during the year that Mitt Romney ran, where everybody on the Republican side says, I'm a proud conservative. It got so crazy that Mitt Romney said, I'm a severe conservative. So, but do you ever hear Democrats saying, I'm a proud liberal?
No, I think, so first of all, let me just say, you know, give some credit where credit is due. There is a growing group of Democratic pollsters and thinkers and writers and strategists who are breaking out of this mode and who are running campaigns that are more proud of being a Democrat and being a progressive and combining that with a strong populist message. You know, that's how Sherrod Brown not only won in Ohio in 2012, but he ran several points ahead of Obama, in spite of the fact that Rove spent more money against him than in any other Senate race in the country. And I can go through state after state in 2012 as well as 2014, where Democrats ran proud progressive campaigns in tough states and won. So it's not like nobody's thinking about this. I will also say, There's a new book coming out in February by Steve Phillips, who's a friend of mine, where he makes the case for this kind of campaign, this proud progressive campaign that focuses on voter registration, get out the vote of people of color and of progressive voters. And it's a great book. I've already had a chance to read it. So more and more people are making that argument. But to get back to the heart of your question, I think part of the problem, frankly, is that a lot of the people who are running the Democratic Party right now are in their, you know, 60s and 50s, and they grew up in the era of Reagan and the 80s, where it really was tough to run as a Democrat and be a Democrat, and that conservative mindset got set, and it made my generation of Democrats, because I'm 55, I'm in it, but it made my generation of Democrats defensive and cautious about running as progressives. And then when Clinton ran, you know, more as a moderate, although he certainly had some populist language that he used, but when he won, you know, sort of broadcasting, I'm a new kind of Democrat, I'm a more centrist Democrat, people thought, well, okay, we lost against Reagan. Clinton won with this message. This is the way we're going to go. And so, there was reasonable enough reason back in the 80s and 90s to sort of grow up with that idea. But now it's 25 years later. The demographics have changed dramatically, which Steve Phillips talks about in his book. The sense of political dynamics have completely shifted, and we need to get our act together as a party and start focusing on the fact that there's a potential progressive majority in this country and that we can run as progressives. And in fact, that's the only way we win is running that way.
And the guy that's bringing in the biggest crowds on the Democratic side, Bernie Sanders, is the one that the party sort of tried to, suppress in a way. So it's crazy, you know. But
it is.
I thank you for joining us, Mike Lux.
Yeah, happy to do it. I always enjoy talking with you, and I look forward to doing so again.
Thanks a lot, and have a happy Christmas.
You too.
And again, I've been speaking with Mike Lux, who's a partner at Democracy Partners and the co-founder and CEO of Progressive Strategies. He served as a special assistant to the President for Public Liaison in the White House from 1993 to 1995, and he's the author of the widely praised book, The Progressive Revolution, How the Best in America Came to Be. And he has an article at the Huffington Post, What Are Democrats to Do?
so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD Medscape. His latest article at NBC is Analysis: Shreckley Isn't to Blame for High Drug Prices in the U.S. Welcome to Background Briefing, Arthur Kaplan.
Thanks for having me.
And in the note that I got for you, you referred to Shreckley, the so-called Wolf of Farmer Street, the hoodie-wearing perp walk character, who everybody's celebrating his arrest, at least a lot of people are, that the evil little twerp, which I thought was a fairly succinct description. But I take it that there's a broader message here.
Well, the problem is focusing on this guy who clearly has retired the Jerk of the Year in Healthcare Award. I'm not arguing that, jacking up prices on a $7 drug 2,000% when it's a life-saving medicine for many, and then getting involved in all this securities fraud that he's charged with. He certainly is not deserving of any respect or particular consideration, but he's a sideshow. Every American is facing huge costs in drug prices. We have a continuing escalation of cost of drugs and generic ones, too, not as rapid as Shreckley's price increase, but over the years, pretty steep. And we got to pay attention to that because that's where the problem is. It isn't just with this marginal character.
Well, specifically, he raised the price of Daraprim, which is used to treat sort of secondary infections that those suffering from AIDS have, particularly, protozoals. They're parasites, right? Is that what?
Directly. And it also helps a little against malaria,
right?
Another group that doesn't have the money to buy that drug at those prices.
Sure. So he raised the cost of this 62-year-old drug 5,500% from $13.50 a tablet to $750 per tablet. And, of course, the securities charges that he was arrested on by the FBI preceded. In fact, it was the money that he made in the hedge fund that the FBI's charging is, in fact, was a Ponzi scheme. The money that he got from that was what he bought Turing Pharmaceuticals.
Right,
That's the sort of timeline, isn't it?
That's it. And, again, you know, so there he is doing these shenanigans on the side. But meanwhile, saline, which all of us use in the hospital to keep us rehydrated when we go in there, bags of saline, they've gone up about 200% over the past 5 years, and I can trust in no one has invented anything new about salt water. Cancer drugs costing $100,000, $200,000 per year per treatment, not uncommon, with copays of $30,000, $40,000, $50,000. That impacts everybody. That impacts all of us. And so prices are not, you know, the provenance of this little goofball. They're a systematic issue throughout the whole healthcare system, and just putting this guy on trial or, you know, beating him up or having a congressional hearing about him, that's not getting to where the problems are.
So are you suggesting, Arthur Kaplan, that this is a distraction in a way, that this is a feel-good moment, a real bad actor gets arrested, and we're supposed to feel that some justice is being meted out?
Precisely. I think we could send him away forever, and tomorrow morning we'd all wake up and say, boy, that cancer medicine, I don't know if I could afford that. Or how come the generic drugs don't exist, they should, to compete with some of these name brand drugs that are off patent? And there are all kinds of reasons to explain that. I think the real problem is we're paying three times the prices on drugs that they pay in Britain, six times higher than Brazil, 16 times higher than India, where, by the way, there are plenty of millionaires and middle-class people, not just poor people. Why are we the world's the pharmaceutical industry's go-to place to subsidize everybody else on Earth. And why does Congress and why do our leaders put up with such enormous differences in the price of drugs? That's the key issue. Can't lose sight of that no matter what happens to this guy.
And again, I'm speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who is a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and healthcare issues for WebMD/Medscape. His latest article at NBC is Analysis: Shreckley Isn't to Blame for High Drug Prices in the U.S. So I suspect, Arthur, that we're going to really sort of circle back here to campaign finance, aren't we? I mean, isn't that, it's the clout of Big Pharma to basically buy our Congress in order to extend patents on drugs, et cetera, that's driving this. Is that your analysis?
Yep, that's a huge part of the problem. There's an enormous lobbying presence in Washington from not only the pharma and biotech industries, but all health-related industries, and they don't allow change to come. We also don't bargain prices. Every other country on Earth bargains with pharmaceutical and drug companies about prices. We leave it to the industry to set the prices outside of the VA health system and Department of Defense. That's clearly crazy. Saying, yeah, you tell us what it costs and we'll pay it. And then we have all kinds of shenanigans, such as drug companies stepping in and saying to generic companies, don't make a competitive drug that's cheaper. We'll pay you not to do it. So, yeah, I'm afraid our politicians are beholden to the industry. They're not acting in our best interest.
So let's get back then to the argument that the pharmaceutical companies offer up, which is the expense of R&D. Now, my understanding is, first of all, the taxpayer spends quite a lot of money on R&D through the government itself's research. So what's the real story here about net, you know, getting back your investments in R&D, the necessity of charging these huge amounts of money because of the outlays that have gone into R&D? Has anybody really looked into that?
A little bit. And I'd say three things about that, although you could say probably 300. But the first is the industry makes enormous, ridiculous profits. So arguing about the need to charge that much, they're just out of sync with, say, you know, the computer industry or any industry. Nobody gets returns like this. And innovation is certainly not, and on the back burner in other industries in the U.S., and they don't have that kind of margin. Second problem is, I don't believe this is recouping costs. I think it's just charging what you can get away with because you have a monopoly due to long patents. So I think they charge us what they can charge us, independent of recouping costs from research. And the last thing I'll say is, they're not spending that much on research. They're spending a lot more on marketing and advertising than they are on research. So I don't know. I don't find these arguments persuasive.
Well, if watching television is a scientific proof, I must say that almost every ad nowadays on television are for drugs.
Right. And by the way, you know, we're the only country besides New Zealand that permits that kind of direct-to-consumer advertising. I don't think that's a good thing to allow. Some people say, well, it's how you can find out about drugs and so forth, but you know, really, the way the ads are pitched, just seeing someone with an allergy run through a field of flowers, I'm not sure is educational.
Well, yeah, most of them are to do with sexual dysfunction that involve people sitting in separate bathtubs, which I find a rather strange.
You think the entire nation was unable to consummate.
Right. Well, I think if you're in separate bathtubs, that may be one of the reasons why. So the other thing that I brought up, though, is how much is government research helping Big Pharma?
Well, you know, Big Pharma has and biotech, too, they have a good deal because we pour tax money in through the National Institutes of Health. It accounts for about 50% of all research that's done, certainly a bigger percentage of basic research, and then the industry picks the winners and pursues those. Now, we're never going to have a government-run pharmaceutical industry. That is long since past ever happening. But to have the capital put in by us and then get gouged again at the price end, it's a pretty good system if you're a pharmaceutical company.
So the other aspect in terms of what we're talking about, the role of Congress in taking campaign donations from Big Pharma and then gifting them by slipping in a little word or two into a must-pass spending bill that extends the patent on a drug. I mean, just to do a cost-benefit analysis there. If you give a politician, say, $1 million, if you're a big pharmaceutical company, extending the patent on one of your drugs would net you billions, right? So isn't it one of the most cost-effective things you could ever possibly do in business? Buy a politician and get an extension on the patent?
Buying a politician, getting extensions on your patents is incredibly lucrative. It makes you into a monopoly, prevents you from the competition that everybody in Congress is so eager to invoke as the way we can contain costs, although I don't think that's happened for the past 40 years. So what are we talking about? You have a drug, and let's say it's a pain medication. You patent it. It works fine. But your patent is going to run out. What you do is you make a pain medicine extender, and you say, oh, it's going to slowly release the medicine, and so instead of taking it three times a day, you just take it once in the morning, and you're good all day. That's a patent extension. Shouldn't be. You didn't really discover any new drug. You're just finagling around with the drug's administration, but you can make a fortune with that kind of extension.
And the other piece of congressional largesse to Big Pharma is the fact that during the George W. Bush administration, they passed a law forbidding Medicare and Medicaid from bulk buying pharmaceuticals so that the government couldn't demand a discount for bulk buying, which would lower the price for enormous percentage of the medication in this country.
Yeah, if I could afford them, I'd be swallowing a ton of experimental blood pressure medicines right now when you point that out, because it is absolutely insane. Why would we take the government's ability to bargain prices off the table in extending a benefit of more coverage to seniors? And by the way, what happens is copays go up. So individuals get coverage, but then they wind up having to pay more and more out of pocket to subsidize what the government will pay. And we get no price control. So in every other government, they're sitting there haggling, using their purchase power to say, you know, this is what the price is going to be. Our government should say, between the VA, Department of Defense, Medicare, and Medicaid, sit down at a table and let's talk price. But we took it off the table completely nuts.
But don't the VA and the DOD, aren't they allowed to bargain, or are they not allowed to bargain either?
You know, they don't really bargain. What they do is they get a lower cost given to them by the pharmaceutical industry, but it's, in my view, a divide-and-conquer approach. Taking them out of the game then makes Congress feel less pressure to do anything about the Medicare situation.
But just in the last couple of minutes, just getting back to this, what appears to be a new outrage, and not just the Shreckley gouging the price up by 5,500%, for one pill on a life-saving drug. Many other life-saving drugs, as you've pointed out, their new cancer treatments are incredibly expensive. And it's simply outrageous that people would have to make a choice between, or would have to bankrupt themselves to stay alive on pills, which is probably what happens more often than not. So you either choose to say, well, I can't afford it and I have to die, or two, I'll have to spend every last penny in my wealth and what possible stuff that could be handed down to my kids. Is that what's going on?
That is what's going on. Many Americans are in medical debt to try and afford some of these new high-priced medicines. And while I'm really excited about this new generation of drugs to treat things like cancer, the fact is some of them only add a couple of months for the $100,000, $200,000, and you may stay in bed and your quality of life doesn't improve much. Others are great. They really put the disease in remission and can have a big impact. So we've got to sort through, again, what are we getting for our money? Is it worth it? It's one thing to say it's $100,000, you get another 2 months and you never leave bed with you if you have lung cancer, or yeah, it's $100,000, but we cure you. You know, that's what we've got to start sorting out here.
And there's no way to get them down. They are justifiably high because of R&D again, which is the main excuse?
Well, I think we could get them down if Congress would finally sit down and say, you know what, we're going to force some bargaining here. Everybody has to negotiate the prices with Medicare. Right now, Medicare doesn't do much of that, nor does Medicaid. I think you could drive the prices down on some of these things.
Well, Arthur Kaplan, I thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Arthur Kaplan, who's a professor of bioethics and director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the NYU Langone Medical Center's Department of Population Health. He writes a regular column on bioethics for NBC.com and is a monthly commentator on bioethics and health care issues at webmd/medscape. His latest article at NBC is Analysis: Shreckley Isn't to Blame for High Drug Prices in the U.S. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now from the UK is Andrew Jennings, an investigative reporter best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. Since March of 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging, and Ticket Scandals. And his latest book is El Muerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. Welcome to Background Briefing, Andrew Jennings.
Hello there. That book, by the way, has been updated yet again. It's now done as, The Dirty Game. Yes, the reporter who brought down Sepp Blatter. Plug. Right, ask me a question.
Let me repeat that. The Dirty Game, the reporter who brought down Sepp Blatter.
That's right.
And that's you.
That's me.
Well, how are you feeling now that he's been banned?
Well, I'm quite pleased, but there's a long way to go yet with the investigation, and it has been, I mean, it's a dubious mob who've done it, because they're all hired by Sepp Blatter. Initially, they just picked the people who was running against him and took them out. Then suddenly, he got so badly burnt, so much, just awful stuff about him. They realised if they were going to survive, they had to turn against him. So they turned against him today. And in one sense, he's quite right, but it's dubious.
Well, obviously, the rats are deserting a sinking ship, or at least are trying to right the boat. Clearly, though, Vladimir Putin weighing in on Sepp Blatter's behalf did not work.
I don't think that worked one little bit. You see, that group didn't pay much attention to it. But far more important, Loretta Lynch at the Department of Justice and Michael Lauber, the Swiss Attorney General, weren't paying any attention at all. They were too busy just sifting through the stuff they've got, preparing charges, and that's what really matters.
And what's the significance of Michael Platini being banned as well?
Well, he's just another one who got caught. He got away for a long time because he had a very charismatic character, very nice smile, always got a friendly word, and he took money. But he didn't talk about the last thing.
And he's the president of the UEFA, which oversees soccer in Europe.
The UEFA, yeah, well, they're going to have to sort out what they do about it. But it's all fun. I do emphasize there's no tragedy here, where these people are long overdue at FIFA. FIFA needs to be closed down. We need several convocations of the fans around the world to talk about what sort of FIFA they'd like to see, because football things are going to go on, although FIFA will die.
Well, but it may be fun, but it's been a tragedy for the longest time that one of the most popular games in the world has been hijacked by a bunch of these, you know, these low-life, self-righteous crooks hiding behind all of that Swiss rectitude.
Well, yeah. Fortunately, it hasn't damaged the game, apart from the fact that by diverting money to their own bank accounts, they prevented money going to develop the game and develop the game for kids playing in poor countries. But they'll come back from it, and hopefully they'll dance on their graves.
So what do you think the impact of this banning is going to be on both Russia and, of course, the Gulf, the gutter games, which...
I'd rather wait for you to ask me that when one of the two legal authorities swoops. Depends who they take out. I think that they have got the Qatar bribes, because 10 days ago in London, Loretta Lynch said, very pointedly, very politely, we do hope Qatar will cooperate. In other words, we've got the details. What way you want it? But you're going to get it. So this will be a joy to read. Joy. Earlier 2010, well, it could be. I mean, Lauber, the Swiss Attorney General, I had an hour with him in my recent film, didn't spend any time at all being concerned, quite rightly, with what might concern FIFA. He doesn't care about the football calendar. He just cares about crooks. So stand by. It was the greatest story ever told.
Well, interesting enough, in the last presidential debate on the Democratic side that took place on Saturday night, Hillary Clinton brought up the fact that in the context of the wars going on in Syria and Iraq against the Islamic State, she said that Qatar could pony up and join and put some boots on the ground instead of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on the World Cup. She didn't actually hit it on the nail on the head, but what did you think of that remark?
Well, it's quite right, of course. We really are getting fed up. We started with, do you think you ought to do something? A year later, excuse me, you ought to do something. That was in 2011. In 2015, they still haven't abolished the kafala system. They've got no right to hold the games. One way or another, the sooner they get it out, the better.
But what's happening with the fact that it'd be in, 120-degree heat?
Yeah, but that won't bear any, it won't have significance at all, because a new set of executives are going to get it out fast. Only money, bribes, money under the table, over the table, whichever way it went, got it to Qatar, and it's got to go out. An apology would be quite nice from Qatar on the way, but I doubt we get that.
So what do you think, though, about the World Cup in Russia? Is that in jeopardy?
I think it's certainly in question, because, again, well, two things. First of all, it was got in the most dubious of circumstances. Although, unlike Qatar, football is genuinely played in Russia. It is a footballing nation. How good they would have been for the right to hold it, I'm not at all sure. On the other hand, have you seen, sanctions are biting on Moscow. They can't import a lot of the stuff they assume they're importing. They're cutting back on their developments, and I think we might find, three in a bed. So let's see what happens.
But do you think, though, that given this 8-year suspension of both Platini, the head of the European Soccer Federation, and Sepp Blatter, who he looks as if he might be a little delusional now, he's behaved somewhat erratically since all this blew up in his face, and frankly, it would not have happened but for the dogged reporting on your part over the years. And I must say that your colleagues in the journalistic world, and particularly the sports journalists, didn't really join.
Oh, dear.
They didn't join you, did they? I mean, you were out.
No, for the New York Times down to any paper, and that's just America. They never got the point, and perhaps they never will. But it will happen, because these law enforcement agencies have got to do it. The Swiss were reluctant at first, but now they've realised they've simply got to. And I think they're doing a good job. Just to have a nice holiday this Christmas. You know, go away, don't read the newspapers, and then come back and see how the story develops, because Blatter's just making silly noise.
But what about the guy that's been extradited from Switzerland, who's here in the United States? Presumably, the Justice Department is building a case, right? That's what's going on behind the scenes.
The ones that have been extradited, almost without exception, are attorney state witness. And if they don't hurry up soon and finally get Jack Warner next spring out of Trinidad, he's going to find that everybody's been, Nick, they're being witnesses for the state, and he'll be told, we don't want to talk to you, Mr. Blatter, Mr. Warner, we just put you on trial. I think that's really funny as well.
But why?
They're so overdue. So if you think of... I don't mind it, but Warner spat at me, he attacked me. And what sort of executive this is of world football? They saw it, they did nothing. He was fine by then.
But is there a problem getting him out of Trinidad? They can't...
Warner is playing all the legal tricks possible. It's now set for February. Before very long, there'll be a quiet phone call to the Prime Minister in Port of Spain saying, look, we don't want to interfere in the justice system. Where do you sell your minute but important amount of oil to? Yeah, well, just think about it, okay? Bang, down with the phone. And then, you know, and Jack can stay in Trinidad. The one voice that stood out against American imperialism as the country's economy crumbles. So let's just wait and see how long it takes for the guest in a sense.
So in other words, it's the old adage that patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel?
I think he's just a scoundrel. I wouldn't give anything more than that.
So you mentioned earlier, Andrew Jennings, that the people who banned Sepp Blatter and Marco Platini, the officials at FIFA, are pretty much all the hand-picked cronies and crooks of Sepp Blatter himself, and that they're really acting out of self-preservation. But I understand that a lot of the big sponsors have weighed in, Visa and I think Coca-Cola and others, and have said that they're pulling their money. That must have got their attention.
Let's just wait and see. At last they have, made a spirited statement, which is a change from what they said for the last couple of years, which is, we're sure they're going to reform, boom, down to the phone, because they want the World Cup. I think they're getting the message now, it's dirty business, and you've got to make your mind up where you stand. But I wouldn't count on the sponsors. Their interest is selling Cokes, selling Big Macs, selling motor cars, selling beer, not reforming FIFA. So I would not get drawn into believing that we get anywhere with the sponsors.
Well, then, given that your feeling is that nothing's going to change unless FIFA is abandoned and replaced by a legitimate organization representing world soccer, who is going to bring that about? What movements do you notice out there to basically replace FIFA with a decent...
Well, I don't want any existing organisation to replace FIFA, so we'll have the old game all over again.
Uh-huh.
I think let's hear what the fans have got to say. There's no hurry. It's only football. There'll be football every Saturday in every community in the world. Jolly good luck to it. FIFA is just a supernumerary, and we make out they're very important. And in time, the fans will say, well, if we get complete transparency, like with your government. I mean, goodness sake, if we can find out what the president earns, we can find out minute detail in government. For goodness sake, we can't do it in FIFA. Which century are they in? If they think that we have any, just a shred less, then we'll be coming down on them again.
Right, but who is leading or who is proffering this idea that...
Terrible, terrible. Last thing we want is any talk of leaders. I don't know. I know there's about 2 or 3 billion people involved in football. I think there's some quite bright people emerge from that. And I'd like this to let it happen. My job is investigating and catching the crooks. Right. I'm not sure reporters have got any more skills than anybody else at saying what is the replacement.
Right. Well, but do you believe that it doesn't need to replace? Somehow it can all operate on its own, and World Cups can be put together.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, what do you need this great big monstrosity on top? A vast amount of money, and we're not told how much, just round figures, and probably not true. We're not told where the money's gone. Just occasionally we get a glimpse, like with this Platini business, just 2 million francs, you know, nothing to matter about. What?
Right.
So I think we just say to the fans, it's your call, what are you going to do? And stand back and watch.
Right. Well, there's no question that there's millions and millions of people that love the game around the world. One hopes that somehow spontaneously they can create a critical mass that both ejects these crooks and doesn't necessarily replace it with any organization, but somehow can come up with something that puts together these World Cups. I can't imagine they're going to happen on their own.
Well, let's just wait to see. There's a vast amount of pretense upon, you know, what sort of organisation it really needs.
Right.
A very basic organisation. We'll see, though. I shall wait and see. I shall retire from it, doing it.
Right.
I just didn't want just on a one-hour film, which basically quite nice. It went up before the latest arrests were made, or rather the charges went in. Let's see. If they're still asking the new year, well, we'll be back again, won't we?
Right. So this film is going to be played on the BBC?
I think it's been on the BBC World Service last weekend, actually.
Uh-huh. Well, how would we get it here in the United States?
Send me your email. I'll send you a copy. If you promise to send it to 10 people.
I will. I'll do that.
Okay.
And I like your idea. I think, you know, it's like you're more or less suggesting a kind of version of the Hippocratic Oath. First do no harm, you know. So let's wait and see that maybe we don't need an organization to replace FIFA. The game is going to
be very, very, very low key. None of this, you know, great big sort of facade is procession. Gosh, Blatter's coming. All touch the ground. No, the president's come. Hello, have a cup of tea. Nice to meet you. Sit down. Now let's talk about organisation, shall we?
Well, Andrew Jennings, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it.
Cheers, mate. Okay,
bye-bye. Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with Andrew Jennings, who's an investigative reporter, best known for his work investigating and writing about corruption in the IOC and FIFA. And since March of 2003, Andrew has been the only reporter in the world banned from FIFA President Sepp Blatter's press conferences. His books include Foul, The Secret World of FIFA, Bribes, Vote Rigging and Ticket Scandals, and Omerta, Sepp Blatter's FIFA Organized Crime Family. And his latest book is The Dirty Game, The Reporter Who Brought Down Sepp Blatter. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.